still, I was just thinking about this, we're still not actually out of the Bible, out of the Old Testament, still not actually out of the time period that Bill was going over in his set of classes. We're getting to the point where we're going to be out of that probably next week. Daniel chapter 8, just to kind of put it in perspective, Daniel says, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after one that appeared to me the first time, and I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. And I saw a ram pushing west. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And I was, as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And then he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram, and he was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in the place of it, four notable ones came up towards the four winds of the heaven." And as we looked last week, if you look down at verse 21, it says the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is its first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. We're almost to that point now, what I would call the Greek period. But in the meantime, what we're doing, again, is setting up this period of time to get to that Greek period, to kind of understand the we'd call the geopolitical nature of this area at the time. The Persian Empire still is going strong. Last week we ended up talking about Darius, or if you want to, Darius. There are a number of different pronunciations of that term, of that name. Darius the first was the king. I found this, actually just this week, I found this, which might help explain a little bit how Darius came to have a claim on the throne itself. And you can see that this is called the Achaemenid Empire. That's what, if you look up the Persian Empire, it's called the Achaemenid. And it's because of this guy at the top here, Achaemenes, who is a king of Persia. And as you can see, it goes down, and the line splits here, right here, and we have Cyrus the First, which is not Cyrus the Great, because if you look down, his son is Cambyses, and his son is Cyrus the Great. And Cyrus the Great, of course, is the one that really united the Persian and Mede Empire and started the whole thing in action. And this is his reign dates here, regnal dates, I think is what you call them. And so, but on the other side here, you can see going down, you've got different, you've got these guys going down, and you've got, how do you say that, Hystapes is the father of Darius the Great. And what happens is that when Cambyses dies, going back to take out Gematra or his actual brother or... we're not sure, really. History's not sure he actually was the one that he went back after he rebelled. If he did die, this imposter, Gematra, who supposedly looked like Smerdis, took control, and Cambyses was on his way back to stop him when Cambyses died. Now, whether Cambyses was poisoned or not, we talked about that, or whether he actually just accidentally stabbed himself in the thigh and got gangrene and an infection and died. Regardless of that, seven nobles rose up to decide who would take control, and Darius was one of those. And Darius is actually not considered royal because he's not of this line, but he was a noble of sorts. And he was actually Cambyses' lance man, his lance bearer. So if you think about that, Cambyses would maybe be in a chariot and Darius would be there protecting him. It's like his bodyguard. And so Darius actually becomes king, and the first thing he does is he marries Cyrus's daughter, Atossa, and that actually cements his rule as king of Persia, because now he's married into nobility. Out of that union, actually, Darius the Great had several children by his first wife before he became famous. But once he married Atossa, out of that union becomes Xerxes the Great, who we would call Ahasuerus, or however you want to say it, the king that we see in the book of Esther. But the Greeks named him Xerxes, or Xerxes the Great. And out of that union, and we'll talk about that a little bit later today, comes Artaxerxes the First. Now, whether that's Esther, which I don't believe it is, or a woman named Amestris, which I do believe it is, we'll talk about that a little bit. So this gives you a little bit of an idea of the lineage of these guys. Why do we care? I don't know. I find it kind of interesting in this particular case, but it does tell you why Darius had a claim to the throne in the first place. So as we go through this, just kind of keep that in mind. And these guys go all the way down, by the way. They go all the way down. We'll talk a little bit about Xerxes. The line almost ended at Xerxes, because Xerxes was actually killed by a eunuch and the captain of his guard, and who was planning on taking over the empire himself. But through fate or whatever, God allowed these guys to go on. And Artaxerxes here, by the way, Artaxerxes is the one that allows them to start rebuilding. He's the one that sends Nehemiah to Jerusalem, Nehemiah being pricked in his heart by God and asking Artaxerxes, and Artaxerxes sends him and eventually makes him governor of Judea for a little while. I can see that God had his hand in that. Again, another fullness in time type of a thing. So we have this lineage of Cyrus and Darius and the nation that comes out of that. I just wanted to show you a couple of pictures. I hope these are visible enough. This is actually, you don't usually see this angle, but this is Persepolis. This is the city that Darius built. We don't look at it as very large, I suppose, but this is the palace complex here, this whole area. We normally look at this. This is, if you can see these columns and these archways right here, this is normally the view that you see of those, this view here and this view here. But this complex was actually quite large, and you can see that there's a couple of really imposing edifices here. These little things here were all columns. And they were designed to, they didn't have steel girders. The best thing that they would have had in a case like this would have been timbers. But this area is not really rich in timber either. So what they would do is they'd put up these columns, and then they would put the blocks of stone on top of those. In order to span a large area like this wide, you'd have to have multiple columns. And to give you some perspective on the size of these columns, there's a man right there. So this would have been the hall of 100 columns here, or maybe this one. But these are supposed to be really imposing edifices. And they would have been made out of stone and mud brick. Think about that. When you think about the engineering that goes into all of this. Babylon, Nineveh, this place, made out of mud and stone. And so you can see the stone here, they've carved it. These columns are made out of stone. Intricately carved. I can imagine that in their time, this was a really beautiful place, designed to wow people. And again, here's another view of that. And you've got some columns and stuff. And this is, that's all I've got for that. But again, Darius started building this, and Xerxes added on to it and finished what Darius. In fact, there's a whole lot of inscriptions there that says something along the lines of, what my father didn't finish, I've finished, and I've added on to it, is what Xerxes would have done. Yes?
And that's the Greek name of that particular city, obviously.
It's interesting. It's interesting, yeah, because polis is a Greek term, so it's yeah, so it's like Persia City is what we'd call it, right? I guess so. I don't know the answer to that, but I guess you're probably right, Mike. But anyway, I just thought these guys weren't just making war, a lot like Nebuchadnezzar, in fact, where Nebuchadnezzar strove to create Babylon into this great city. That's what these guys did, too. They were builders as well, something that we probably don't give them a lot of credit for. But it's a pretty neat city. So we were talking last week a little bit about Xerxes. This carving here is this carving right here. This is also in Persepolis. This guy here is actually Darius the Great, and this guy standing behind him is actually Xerxes. This is one of the only, there's only like two or three carvings of Xerxes that I've found on the internet. You just can't find pictures of Xerxes that aren't artist renditions or something like that. I have another one later. But we talked a little bit about Xerxes last week. I wanted to cover a couple of other things. Again, remember that Darius had tried to take the Greek mainland and was defeated at Marathon, and then went back to do preparations to do it again, but in the meantime he was killed. And Xerxes actually vowed to take up where his father left off because he thought that it was an embarrassment that he was defeated at Marathon. And so Xerxes creates a fairly large army, and I've got the numbers here. It varies anywhere from 150,000 to 300,000 men. When you think about that, that's a big army. Now, the one thing about that army is that they weren't all Persians. The Persian Empire spanned a number of different nations, and it says that this army is supposed to be made up of 50 different nations. So they were either conscripted or volunteered or whatever, but he brought a large army, and anywhere from 600 to 1,200 ships. I've seen the number 600, 800, and 1,200, and that's a lot of ships. The Athenian navy was not that large. It dwarfed the Athenian navy. But again, I think that we'll see that God had a hand in the defeat of the Persian Empire here. They're going to go after Greece, and they're not going to be able to keep it. And so again, Xerxes, this is actually prior to the time of Esther. So we want to keep that in mind. So Xerxes, we talked about the Battle of Thermopylae, but Xerxes comes through. He crosses the Hellespont here. And again, we talked about him having the Hellespont whipped with whips, 300 lashes, and having manacles thrown into it, because the bridge that they created got blown away in a storm and it upset him. He has another bridge built, basically a pontoon bridge, and they cross over. Alexander does the exact same thing, but he does it with boats. They put boats across it and lash them together and put planks across, and he takes his cavalry and his men across the boats. So again, this is a very narrow. I guess you'd call that a canal between Europe, which is right here, and Asia, which is right here, and that's the easiest way to get across with a lot of men. So that's the route that they took, and they come around here, and they're coming through the north area of Macedonia and the north part of Greece. This is actually Greece right here, this whole area in the peninsula, and the Greeks decided. By the way, Sparta is down here. Where's Sparta? Sparta's down here. And Athens is over here, and they decided that the majority of the Greek city-states decided that they wanted to fight in the south instead of the north. So when Xerxes came through, these guys just surrendered up here because they didn't have any way of withstanding him. So they come down, and they're going to have a battle here, but they're also going to have a sea battle here. And the battle of Thermopylae is very famous, and we talked about that a little last week. That's where Leonidas had a large contingent of the Greek army to fight off the Persians. But what happened is that they were betrayed, and so Leonidas sent everyone off except for 300 men, and then held the pass at Thermopylae for a while, so that the army could retreat and so that they could withdraw from Athens, because Xerxes' main goal was to take out Athens. And the reason for that's going to become clear in a little bit. But Athens had a lot of influence on these city-states over here, these Ionic city-states that kept rebelling against Persia, because they were Greek city-states, and Persia wanted them in control, and they wanted Athens out of the picture. So they fight at Thermopylae, which is this battle here, a narrow pass. But in the meantime, his navy's coming down here, and there's a battle here at this place called Artemisium. and a lot of the Greek ships were lost. And let me see what I have on my notes here. Themistocles proposed that the allied Greeks block the advance of the Persian army at the Pass of Thermopylae and simultaneously block the Persian navy in the Straits of Artemisium. And so these are the Straits of Artemisium. And you see a number of things here. And one of the things that the Persian fleet did is they divided. And some of them were going to go around to get to Athens this way, and some of the rest were going to go down through here. Why would they want to go down through this area here? Do you have any idea? Open sea is still a problem for these kind of ships, right? This is blocked on land by both sides. You're not going to have any storms come up, because what happened, and again, I think you see God's hand in this, is that the part of the fleet that went down this way, about a third of the fleet was lost because of they would consider an unseasonable storm. A gale came up and destroyed a third of Xerxes' fleet. Is that a good thing for the Athenian navy or not? It's a good thing for the Athenian navy. So again, that's one of the reasons that they would come down this way. So there was a naval battle up here. It says that a third of their 1,200 ships coming around the coast of Magnesia, which is this way, were lost. The Persians sent a detachment of 200 ships around the coast, an attempt to trap the Greeks. But these were caught in another storm and shipwreck. So now he's lost about half of his fleet so far going down. It seems like God is just saying, okay, the Greeks are going to win here. The Greeks are going to win here. They lost at Thermopylae, but that wasn't their main gambit. Their main gambit was to build ships. Themistocles, the Athenian general, convinced them that that would be the way to defeat the Persians, was on the water. Even though they had superior trained armies, they were vastly outnumbered, but they also had superior navy. So that brings us to the next thing. Now, they lost at Thermopylae, but they really gained in this whole time period. And so the Persian army comes down. They actually take Athens and burn Athens, and then they come back. They come back, and he actually comes out here and supposedly watches this naval battle in Salamis. He's up on a bluff watching the battle and is not happy with what happens. The Persian fleet. Now, if you go back and look, Salamis is this little island right here. The fleet comes around the tip. Now, overall, it's not a big defeat for the Persian Empire, but it's a big defeat for this campaign. Lauren?
It's important to know, though, when we took Athens, the Athenians had evacuated the city and taken anything that could be of value to the Persians.
Correct.
And so Xerxes was depending on capturing Athens with supplies, their food and so on. All of that was gone. And so in his rage, he burns the city.
Yep.
It says the battle, he watched the battle, the naval battle, on his throne.
Right.
On his throne with him. And he actually, according to the history, sat in his throne watching his navy being defeated.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. I haven't seen the next 300 movie. There's actually a 300 Battle for the Empire or something like that. I didn't see it, but I saw the previews, and one of the commanders there, actually, you see it in the previews, is a woman. And that's actually true. One of the commanders of Xerxes was a woman, and at one point, and she's just vicious in battle, and at one point he says, oh, I wish that all of my captains were like her, because if he had had all of them like her, he thought he would have won the battle. So you might find it in this day and time kind of surprising, but apparently not. They come in here into the straits, and you can see how they're arrayed. Now, you notice it says Phoenicians here.
Xerxes was in control of Phoenicia at this point in time, and that had added to his navy. Alexander's going to do the same thing later on. Alexander doesn't have a huge navy at one point in time, but when he comes down the coast and captures Sidon, he captures the Phoenician navy, the part that doesn't belong to Tyre. And so that's what gives him the navy when he actually goes to besiege Tyre. He's got ships. And so you'll see that the Persians do the same thing. Go ahead, Mike.
I was just wondering, do you have an image of what they suppose the Persian and Greek ships look like?
Actually, I didn't put that up here, but the Greeks now would be running trimarines, which are their ships with oars. I have pictures of them. I didn't think to put those in here. They're ships with oars, usually a car figurehead, and a ram out in front. And that's generally the way that they did battle, is that they did battle by charging and trying to sink the other ships. So that's also a Phoenician design, so the Phoenicians probably would have been using a similar thing. You see these things all the time, pictures of them. They have big eyes up front. To sea with, and you know, the ships are carved that way, very ornate in their carving. They usually had a single sail, a big square sail that they could when they were out. But when they were fighting like this, they were probably using oars. If you've ever seen the movie Ben Hur, that's pretty much, you know, when Charlton Heston is as Ben Hur is chained as a slave in the galley, and the Roman they're beating out the strokes and stuff and ramming speed, and they start beating faster and stuff. That's most likely what this would have been. So to give you kind of a visual of that. So the ships come in. Let me see what I have written here. Let's see, the Persian navy sailed into the Straits of Salamis and tried to block both entrances. In the cramped conditions of the straits, the great Persian numbers were an active hindrance as the ships struggled to maneuver and became disorganized. Seizing the opportunity, the Greek fleet formed in line and scored a decisive victory. So, and you can see that coming. And so, Xerxes was on his throne watching this happen. Now, at the same time, I actually learned about this earlier. Babylon, the city of Babylon, was trying to rebel against the Persian Empire. And so Xerxes is actually going to leave, and he's going to take most of his army back across the strait, the Hellespont, and back into Persia to put down that rebellion. But he's going to leave a guy in charge, and his name starts with an M, like Mardonius, which actually sounds like a Greek name, if you ask me. So it's probably just like Xerxes is the Greek version of his name. He's going to leave him, and I don't know if I don't have it, but it's back over here. They're going to have one final battle. You can see the Greek army coming up here. The Persian army is going to come down here. Xerxes has already left with the majority of his forces, but the ones that are left are actually defeated at Plataea. And so that really ends this campaign. Well, why do we care? It affects the part of the story of Esther. It affects actually what's going to show us here is that the Greeks can easily defeat the Persians. When Alexander goes against the Persian Empire, do you suppose his people are better trained than the Greeks of this time, or better equipped than the Greeks of this time, or worse? It's going to be about 100 years in the future, right? They're going to be better equipped. They're going to be better trained. The Greeks have developed this. Method of battle called the phalanx. They're the ones that perfected it. The Greek actually, we'll see in a little bit, the Greeks hired themselves out as mercenaries also. So the reason we care about this is because it shows the Greeks that the Persians can be defeated in battle. And also it gives them a little bit of encouragement later on when Alexander goes against Persia. They're actually out for blood. They're actually out for revenge. And so we see that going through. But it does show us that the Persians can be defeated in battle. They're not this huge, undefeatable army. And again, if you go back to the description that we read in the book of Daniel, the ram pushed every direction that it wanted to, and nothing could withstand it. Then the goat comes, and the ram cannot withstand the goat. They're not going to be able to defeat the Greek Empire.
That really takes us over to the Book of Esther. And I've got, I wanted to, do I have another slide in here? I do actually, I put these out of order. These are actually two paintings of Esther. This is Esther wanting to go before Xerxes.
It kind of gives you the idea, I don't know if you had this idea or not, whether Xerxes had more than one wife, first of all. They didn't have huge harems, as far as I understand, but he had more than one wife. And it's pretty likely that Esther was not his number one wife. It's hard to say. When she goes before him here, she's really in fear for her life because she does not know whether he'll extend the scepter to her or not. And keep in mind, as we've seen, that Xerxes has a little bit of a personality issue as far as fits of rage and stuff like that. And this other painting is kind of a neat painting. You can't really see Xerxes in the background here, but this is Haman. And she's saying, you're the guy that's trying to kill me and my people. And he's going, whoa, you know, this is not a good thing. So these kind of interesting paintings I thought I'd throw in there. Esther 1 through 4, we're actually going to backtrack just a little bit. This is Xerxes in the Book of Esther. You can see here that it says, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. India to Ethiopia means that not only did he have Egypt, he had down the coast of Africa, he had over, they had a huge, huge empire is what they're talking about here. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, then in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all of his officials and servants. The powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the province before him, being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. I happen to agree with what Lauren's idea on this is that what he was doing is drumming up support for going into Greece. He's already had to go into Egypt and put down the rebellion in Egypt. He's come back. That was in the second year of his reign. And when it says the third year of his reign, this is talking about the third year of his reign by himself. He was co-regent with his father for a while, but when Darius died, he became sole king, and that's what this is talking about. In the second year of his reign, he actually goes down and puts down the rebellion in Egypt, keeps that part of his empire, comes back up, and he's about ready. He's making preparations to go into Greece. And to do that, he needs a lot of money. He needs a lot of people for his army. And that's what this would have been all about, getting the funds and the armies and the navy and whatever, preparing for his conquest of Greece. And then, of course, you know the rest of the story is that and since Bill covered this, we're not going to do too much, that Vashti, his queen, was asked to come and stand before them. Now, you could argue whether or not she was supposed to be there naked or whatever. I tend to think that she was asked to come to a drunken party where everyone was drunk, and she refused. Now, the question is who was this Vashti? And from my understanding, it's most likely this woman whose name is Amestris. Some people think that Esther is Amestris, but it doesn't really fit the personality we see in the Bible of who Esther is. Esther seems to be demure, doesn't seem to be bloodthirsty, doesn't seem to want to kill people right and left. She's there to defend her people, but do you think that she would have asked for Haman's life if her people hadn't been in danger? I don't think so. In fact, actually, I don't know that she really asked for Haman's life, but when Xerxes saw him, he'd gone, left the room and come back, and here he was, like, draping himself on his wife, trying to plead his case. He said, are you going to molest my wife too? Paraphrasing. And so it was Xerxes who had him put to death. But Amestris, to give you an idea, a woman offended her, according to Herodotus. A woman offended her, and so she had her basically cut up into pieces. Not a nice woman. So the question is, and Amestris is actually the mother of Artaxerxes. Now the question is whether or not what kind of royal standing does Esther have? She is the queen, but what kind of nobility does she have coming into that? She has none. Is she the number one queen, or is she just one of his wives? It's a good question. And secular history really doesn't tell us much about Esther. Now, they want to make a big deal and say that the name Esther is actually contained in the word, the name Amestris. So that would be like the Esteris. I don't think that the personality that we see in Amestris is actually the personality we see in Esther. So I don't really buy that story. It's more likely that Vashti was Amestris, that she was his queen. She's the daughter of nobility too. But Amestris was supposed to be this haughty woman. Now that could be that Herodotus is writing from a specific slant to make Amestris look bad. But we don't know. Vashti actually is not a name. Do you remember the story of Mariami? Herod and Mariami. Mariami was one of his wives, and he actually found, I think it was, I can't remember who told us the story, but it was in the other building. It was the guy, Tim Hill, I think, came down and told us. But Mariami was his favorite wife, and he found out that Herod thought that she was trying to kill him. So he had her killed and preserved in a big vat of honey. And then he would walk around and call her honey after that. Vashti is that's supposedly true. Vashti actually means sweet one, which actually is kind of interesting when you think of Amestris' personality. But Vashti is not an actual name. It's an appellation. So it would be like calling her sweetheart. So whether or not Vashti is Amestris', which I probably think is true because she was a royal queen, she was from royalty, and then Artaxerxes after that was actually her son. That's my understanding of this situation. Did you have a comment over here, Lauren?
Yeah, I agree that Vashti is the mother of Artaxerxes, which allowed her to contain part of her position as the mother of the heir apparent to the throne. Esther, I believe, became queen.
Correct.
Vashti had been demoted to a wife's position, but when Xerxes went to the campaign of Persia, he took her and Artaxerxes with him on that campaign.
Which was not unusual, because Darius III takes his wives and children with him into battle against the Greeks.
And during that whole time, Xerxes carried on an affair with his brother's daughter or something like that. And there's a whole thing that ends up that she goes and puts out her eyes, and there's just a really bloodthirsty person.
Yeah, actually, I think that's the woman that she cut up because she saw her wearing one of her gowns.
Yeah, her cloak. She made her cloak.
Yeah.
For Xerxes to try to win her position back, and he gave it to his mistress.
Yeah.
And she learns this and goes berserk.
Right. Doesn't really, like I said, that's the kind of story that doesn't make me think that Esther is Amestris.
And later, as Artaxerxes takes the throne, she becomes a powerful person.
Kind of like a queen mother type, right?
A queen mother. She sets out and kills potential rivals, has to have them killed. The potential rivals are Artaxerxes, or
Artaxerxes does some of that himself too. We'll see why in just a minute.
Trisha? He had a lot of power, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Which I don't think Esther really would have had coming from her background.
No.
Go ahead, Trisha.
Esther was not royalty, she was a common Jew.
Correct. She's definitely a concubine, if nothing else.
Yeah, if nothing else. And she didn't have, people being on the earth, especially women, I'm royal and you're not, I don't care what the king says. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that in her as well.
She definitely wasn't raised as a royal, right? So, interesting stuff. Again, later on, now between the period of this feast and the period of the time when he takes her as his queen is the whole Greek campaign. And what we see is Xerxes comes back. He gets Babylon back in order, puts it back in the empire, retreats to Susa is what we call it. It's in the Bible, it's called Shushan. We would call it Susa, S-U-S-A, not S-O-U-S-A. not that kind of Susa. But he retreats there, and from that point, basically, he doesn't go back out into battle again. So he devotes himself to building projects, and that's the Persepolis and stuff like that. So that's how the Book of Esther fits into this whole timeline. And again, one question that I might have is whether Esther had any influence on Artaxerxes at all. Artaxerxes is alive. It's interesting that Artaxerxes is very friendly to the Jews, because he's got Nehemiah as his cupbearer. Nehemiah being a Jew, he gives Nehemiah a long-term leave of absence. He makes Nehemiah governor over Judea. So whether Esther had any influence on that or not is a question we can't answer. In fact, we really don't know what the end of Esther was. We really don't know what happened to Esther after she saved the Jews. Her story for us ends, and secular history has not told us anything about her. So Esther's quite an interesting story. History. When I say story, I don't mean made up. I mean it's an interesting narrative. Go ahead.
If they've identified Mordecai correctly, he served in his capacity up until about 2 or 3 years. Within 2 to 3 years of the end of Xerxes' reign, and things appeared to go very well while he was in that position. But after he apparently passed away,
because he was quite old, actually.
Yes, that he probably passed away. And things did not go as well for Xerxes, which led to his assassination.
Yeah. Now, what Lauren's referring to is there's a couple of Greek names or names that of people that of high power that their names are written and sound a lot like Mordecai phonetically, and so there's questions whether or not. And they're powerful men, and their question is whether or not those guys are actually Mordecai. And I didn't put any of that in my notes. I read about it, but it's quite interesting stuff. So remember, though, what Mordecai was, why Mordecai was blessed by Xerxes, is why Mordecai was raised up to his position, is because he had actually stopped a couple of eunuchs from killing Xerxes. So Xerxes apparently didn't have a good relationship with these eunuchs, towards the end of his life, in 465 BC, in August of 465 BC, he was murdered by Asterbanus, the commander of the royal bodyguard and the most powerful official in the Persian court, with the help of a eunuch, Aspamitres. Why would he need the help of a eunuch? Probably the eunuch got him into his quarters and allowed him to do the dirty deed. So he was assassinated, and it's interesting that this Asterbanus was also, according to another Greek historian, he then accused Crown Prince Darius. By the way, Artaxerxes was not the was not the one who was supposed to come into power. He accused Crown Prince Darius, his eldest son, Xerxes' eldest son, of the murder, and persuaded Artaxerxes to avenge the death by killing Darius. So whether or not Asterbanus kills Darius or Artaxerxes kills Darius, the Crown Prince is actually killed. Artaxerxes comes to power, and he actually kills his other brothers as well. And whether it was at Amestris' behest or Amestris did it, it's hard to say. But Artaxerxes in power. Here's one of the only other. There's an archway somewhere with him on it too, but this is supposed to be another carving of Xerxes, and this is supposed to be his tomb. There's a complex. You can kind of see it here, the way that these mountains are. The Xerxes and Artaxerxes and Darius all have their tombs carved into solid rock here, and on the, you can't really see it very well, but these areas around here are usually covered with cuneiform, and This is kind of by solid rock. I mean, it's more of a sandstony type of rock. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I was just going to comment. You know, we read these histories and we think of how brutal and bizarre these different leaders were. You have this brother killed and that leader killed, and then, you know, but is it really paranoia that they actually are out to get you? I mean, you know, if your father was assassinated, several of your uncles, and all of this was your part of your legacy when you got around the Christmas tree, you know, his stocking was missing because, you know, his closest associate was.
Isn't that why Solomon had Adonijah put to death? Because yeah. By asking for what's her name? Sheba.
Shulamite.
Asking for the Shulamite, thank you, Terry. He was actually making a claim towards David's throne.
Sure.
That's one of the reasons he did that to
Herod. Inherited his slaughtering of his own family.
Yeah.
You know, the leading cause of death in his family was his
yeah.
family.
Yeah. Yeah. And Lauren.
Also, remember what David told Solomon as David was approaching death, what he needed to do to
yeah.
make sure he secured the throne.
Yeah.
And so, even within David's instructing his own sons, he would take retribution or limited rivals.
Right.
And just one other comment there. Interesting that you brought up David, because I was thinking of that very fact that David came out of a, you know, pastoral existence, you know, as a shepherd, and he didn't have that bloodthirstiness and that, you know, that sense of
that.
Huh?
I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, in terms of
patricide. Patricide and
right, because of his own upbringing, whereas Solomon and the generations that came after, you know, had lived in that experience.
One thing that's interesting, a couple of things that's interesting about Artaxerxes, again, if you go over to the book of Ezra, which we're going to in just a moment, Artaxerxes is responsible, you know, Cyrus is responsible for allowing the first wave of Jews to return. Artaxerxes actually allows a second wave to return. That's where Ezra comes to Judea. And at this time, the name of the land is called Judea, as far as I understand. Not Israel. So Artaxerxes comes to the throne, solidifies his throne. One of the things that he does is, because of Athens' influence, and we'll look at this later, called the Delian League, where Athens actually gets influence all over those Greek city-states in Ionia. Because of that, what Artaxerxes does is he bribes the Spartans to make war with the Athenians. And that would be the first Peloponnesian War when we get to it, but the Spartans and the Athenians actually get distracted that way. So he bribes the Spartans to go ahead and fight. I don't think it took very much encouragement, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But if you look at, so during his reign, Ezra led 1,500 exiles back to Jerusalem, and it says that there we read about that, Ezra, there he persuaded the Jews to follow the law of Moses more carefully. Ezra chapter 7, verses 11 and following says, "This is a copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes gave Ezra the priest, the scribe, expert in words, and in the commandments of the Lord, and his statutes to Israel. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, peace and so forth." Do I have a thing for him? I do. "Peace and so forth. I issue a decree that all those of the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites in my realm who volunteer to go up to Jerusalem may go with you. And whereas you are being sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God which is in your hand, and whereas you are carrying the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, and whereas all the silver and gold that you find in all the provinces of Babylon, along with the freewill offering of the people and the priests, are to be freely offered for the house of their God in Jerusalem. Now therefore be careful to buy with this money bulls and rams and lambs and their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God in Jerusalem." So Artaxerxes, again, is very friendly to the Jews and sends Ezra back, and we'll see later that he sends Nehemiah back. So that really kind of brings us as we end up the Old Testament. Artaxerxes is actually the king in charge of the Persian Empire, This is one of the few carvings of Artaxerxes, and it's actually that one right there. You can kind of see it there. This is Artaxerxes' tomb. So you again, it's carved out of solid rock, the same way that they carved the city of Petra out of solid rock. This is the same kind of thing going on here. So Artaxerxes never leads his troops in person like Xerxes does. And towards the end of his life, he really loses interest in the Greek affairs. Most of his successors are equally content to do the same. And none of the later Archimedes show any initiative or intelligence is what scholars believe. So the empire is going to die slowly, but rather collapsing, we talked about this, rather collapsing suddenly, is really kept alive by the bureaucracy that Cyrus and Darius put into place earlier. Go ahead.
One thing too is Nehemiah being sent back and to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. And a large number of scholars believe that from secular history that was done as to protect the empire from a future successful Egyptian revolt. That would be a strong point to prevent the Egyptians coming in further into the Persian Empire. His father had to put down more and more Egyptian revolts during his reign, and so there was a fear about continual unrest among the Egyptians and their potential revolt. And so the rebuilding of the walls was a strategic value to the Persian Empire.
We actually see that idea carried out through even the Greek Empire, right? The king of the north, the Seleucid Empire, the king of the south, the Ptolemaic Empire, they use Palestine or Judea as a buffer state, and they want control of that so that they can keep the battle away from their mainland is the idea. Excellent point, and you can go all the way back to Pharaoh Necho, right, going up to Carchemish to battle against Babylon. If you had something of an armed garrison, so to speak, there, Jerusalem, that they might have to go through them to get north. That's the idea. Good point. So let's just do a little review. Again, we've got the kings of the Persians here. We're going to only talk about one other king in this line, and just some important things that happened. We talk about the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. Again, Cyrus issued his decree in 538. So this gives you a timeline here to build the temple. Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Thermopylae, the Battle of Salamis, all these going on in 480. The Battle of Plataea, 479. This gets the Greeks out of this area. We've got these other kings here. Some of them are interesting. I think we might talk a little bit about this right here. Do I have that in my notes? I do. It's coming up. This retreat of 10,000. Remember, I said that the Greeks were often used as mercenaries. Well, at one point, Cyrus the Younger, I believe, tries to rebel against Artaxerxes II. And when that happens, he hires a whole bunch of mercenaries. And we'll look at what happens to those mercenaries in just a second. But you've got the last king that we want to look at here is Darius III. He's actually the king in charge of the ram at the time that the goat comes. So we'll keep him in mind later on in our talks when we get to the Greeks. This is at the end of this time period, Athens is here. This is actually in Greek. Sorry. Athens is here, and this area all across here is these guys all align themselves with Athens and create what we call the Delian League, and that's because of the island of Delos, which is on here somewhere. Where is Delos? Delos is right here. They got together and created a treaty. What this does is it makes Athens really wealthy because they're a center of commerce and all that. And then you've got Sparta down here, and that's going to lead us to the Peloponnesian War, which is a war that ends up, it's a 10-year war between Athens and Sparta. Basically, two different ideas. Athens is a democracy. Do we live in a democracy? No, we live in a republic, right? What's a democracy?
Each individual person.
Each individual person gets a yay or nay. Actually, it's not just each individual person. It's each individual citizen, right? So it has to be a citizen. And oftentimes those were landowners. It's not your slaves didn't get a vote, but they would come together and they would vote. Now, why is this country not able to be a democracy? We're too big, right? We couldn't all get together in one place and vote. I suppose we could all go down to one place in Seattle and vote, and then they could gather those votes and go. But it's easier with a representative. We're a representative democracy is what we are, a republic. Athens is a democracy. Sparta, place is Sparta? It's definitely the state is in charge. Sparta is a totally different ideology. And by the way, Sparta has been in charge of this whole area for about 500 years. They've been leading this area as a hegemony, where they're supposedly a benefactor in charge of this whole area. And this rise of democracy and the rise of these city-states is definitely not in their best interest. And so they're going to go to war, again, with the urging of Artaxerxes. They're going to go to war, and they're going to fight for about 10 years and come to a draw. Then there's going to be another war after that where Sparta is actually going to win the Second Peloponnesian War. So you get the map of the Delian League here. Athens forms the Delian League in about 478. Socrates is born. You've heard of him, right? He's born in this time period. Hippocrates is born. You know who he is, right? The guy who gives the doctors their Hippocratic Oath, I will do no harm to my patients and stuff like that. He was really the first organized doctor. Not that they didn't have doctors before him, but and the Parthenon began. You know, you've been to Athens and seen the Parthenon, right? Or at least pictures of it. It's hard to believe that that building is 1,500 years old or 2,500 years old. Let's see, 2,500 years old, right? That's a pretty old building. And did you know that there's one in the United States, a full-scale model? I think it's in Tennessee or something like that. You can go, but it's not like the Parthenon, which is a relic. They've actually supposedly restored it to look like it should have looked like when it was first built. So I think it'd be interesting to go visit that. Go ahead, Laura.
Actually, Trish, which is a member of the Florida College Choir, visited the Parthenon. They actually performed from God He is Alive, and the acoustics are amazing.
Cool. We're just about out of time. Let's see. Let's just finish up with this. The Peloponnesian War pits the Delian League against Sparta. 431 is wiped out. This is just a quick anecdote. There's a guy named Xenophon who's also a historian. He's one of the members of this 10,000 Greek mercenaries that go with Cyrus the Younger and try to fight against Artaxerxes II, and they lose, and Cyrus is killed, and Cyrus's army is going to surrender, and their generals come up and to parley, and their generals are killed. Xenophon is chosen to help lead them out, and actually he leads them all the way out. And it's called the Retreat of the 10,000. They didn't want to surrender, and so they basically got out of town, fought their way out, whatever. But there's also Xenophon is another historian that influences Alexander the Great, and that's part of the empire's winding down. Next week we're going to take a brief interlude. We're going to talk about the three different temples that there were at this time period. There's not just one, there's actually three different temples. We've got the temple in Jerusalem, we've got the temple on Mount Gerizim, and we've got the temple on Elephantine Island in Egypt. And so we're going to talk about how those came to be, what happened to them, and whether or not they were rivals of the temple in Jerusalem, and what the significance of that is next time. And that's actually one of those questions. If you want to read John 4, we'll answer some of those questions that you might have in John 4 next week. But thank you for your time.